history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are incredible stories waiting to be heard. We aim to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, we end up learning so much. We're educated, we're entertained, often we're really inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And I imagine that some weeks, this program might be all you hear in the media about World War II. But that is not the case this week. We're going to focus today on something the entire nation remembers once again, the attack on Pearl Harbor 77 years ago on December 7th, 1941. But this week, America also paused to pay tribute to a World War II veteran who went on to become President of the United States, George Herbert Walker Bush. I don't think there was a more moving moment than 95-year-old Bob Dole, the former senator and presidential candidate, being helped from his wheelchair to salute the casket of his fellow World War II veteran. George H.W. Bush never would have become president if he hadn't survived against significant odds on September 2, 1944, when the TBF Avenger the 20-year-old was flying was shot down near Chichijima in the Pacific. Bush was able to bail out and survive thanks to fighter planes that provided protective fire and prevented the enemy from picking him up. He would be rescued by a submarine, while those who bailed out over Chichijima and were captured by the Japanese became the victims of a brutal war crime. They were executed and even cannibalized by their captors. Bush was the last of 8 consecutive presidents who had been in the military during World War II. If you think about that for a moment, it's pretty remarkable. Of course, Franklin D. Roosevelt was the president long before and throughout most of the war. Harry Truman, in essence, ended it with his decision to deploy the atomic bomb, a technology he was completely unaware of until after Roosevelt's passing. And once Truman left office in 1953, every single president for the next 40 years was a World War II veteran. Eisenhower, Kennedy, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, and Bush. Those 8 were among the more than 16 million Americans who put on a uniform and served during that 4-year period we focus on each week. Now, only Carter, whose uniform was that of a midshipman at the U.S. Naval Academy in Annapolis during that time period, remains with us at the age of 94. And when it comes to the other national observance this week at Pearl Harbor, it's estimated that fewer than 2,000 military personnel who were on Oahu that fateful day are still living on the 77th anniversary of the attacks. In a matter of a few short years, that number will decline all the way to 0. And the question is, will the rest of us keep that legacy alive? Will we remember Pearl Harbor? This marks the first year in decades that no survivors of the USS Arizona could make it to the commemoration of Pearl Harbor. Only 5 men from the Arizona remain, and you're going to hear from one of them before we're done today. And since we've had the privilege of meeting so many Pearl Harbor survivors here on Hometown Heroes over the years, I thought we'd piece together a picture of that fateful day through multiple perspectives. 1,177 died aboard the battleship Arizona, nearly half the overall total of those killed that day, but the multi-pronged attack went far beyond Battleship Row. Let's start with a perspective you don't hear too much, a civilian in Honolulu. Clarence Suzuki would go on to serve in the military intelligence service with other Japanese Americans in our then segregated World War II forces. On December 7th, 1941, a peaceful morning in his native Honolulu was interrupted by warfare.
Well, that morning, I was going to Bible training class roughly on the corner of Makalei and King Street in Honolulu, and the Bible training class was about 9:30, and I was at my friend's house about a block away from the church, I think about 8:30 maybe, something like that. And then I heard a big bomb explosion about a block away. This was on the corner of King Street and Makalei Street, and it was anchored by the Miyamoto department store and maybe around 10 other stores along King Street. So after the blast, we were kind of shook up what's going on. So we ran outside and kind of looked, and there was smoke. Shortly thereafter, the police, I mean, the fire department showed up, and then within 5 minutes, the block was on fire. It's spreading through all the stores. It burned the whole place down. But there was the fireman that carried a woman out, and she had her baby with her in her arms, but she was bleeding. And then that was my first exposure to what happened on that day, December 7th. But the fireman told us to go home and just stay there and listen to the radio. So I went home.
Well, and for people who haven't visited Honolulu, I'm just picturing in my mind, now Pearl Harbor is a couple miles west of what you're talking about. These are the streets of Honolulu, closer to Waikiki, just north of the beaches of Waikiki. In fact, I'll never look at that intersection the same now that you've told me that story. Had you had any indication before that that something like this could happen? How big of a shock was it?
During the summer of 1941, you know, now and then we were out to Waikiki Beach. Next door was Kuhio Beach. Waikiki was for the tourists. Kuhio Beach was for the locals. But during the summer, maybe twice a week, we'd be out there swimming, and I would notice that the aircraft carriers were out there on the horizon. Sometimes three, sometimes none. But my understanding in 1941 summer was the islands were on red alert already. Everybody wondered what happened on the Macaulay and King fire, explosion and fire. As it turned out, Pearl Harbor anti-aircraft guns were shooting at the planes, and some of the shells did not detonate as they were supposed to up in the air. They came down on the ground and exploded. And the same thing was in the city of Honolulu. My understanding was about 260 civilians were killed by our own artillery fire, the bombs exploding in the city of Honolulu.
And you came, I guess, fairly close to being another one added to that tally. How far away were you from these explosions and that fire?
Oh, that fire in Macaulay, I was only about a block away. Pretty close.
Close indeed, as was Al Rodriguez, another young man who had grown up in Hawaii, the author of a book called Diary of a Pearl Harbor Survivor, which you can usually find at the USS Arizona Memorial Gift Shop. Al grew up on the island of Kauai, but the Navy gave him a pretty unique vantage point on Oahu on December 7th.
Well, that morning I was stationed at the naval facility called Section Base Bishop's Point, which is at the mouth or the entrance to Pearl Harbor. I just happened to have the duty that morning at the 48 watch, and at about 6:30 we got word that one of our destroyers, the USS Ward, was dropping depth charges on an unidentified submarine. And the message came to our base, and the quartermaster on deck says, "Hey, we got a problem here," and he told me what had happened. At 7:45, I got relieved from my duties and went to have breakfast. I had just sat my tray down when we heard a lot of explosions. And then all of a sudden, the general alarm sounded. We all ran out to the armory where they issued us 30 caliber rifles or 45 pistols when they ran out. And that's all we had to shoot at the planes with. But of course, 1941, the planes were slower than they are today. And they were flying low enough where you could see the pilots' faces. I'm sure we hit the planes because there were enough of us shooting at them. The planes were low enough where, as I said, you could see the pilots' faces.
So you were firing a 45 at the Japanese pilots?
I had a 30 caliber rifle. You know, that was a one-shot thing. You cocked them after every shot, so you didn't fire much. You fired enough, however, because there were enough planes coming down. But like I say, that's all we had to protect us.
How soon did you realize, boy, this is huge, this is enormous, this is catastrophic? Did it sink in right away, or did it take a while?
It sunk pretty fast, because, you know, especially when, you know, I was a storekeeper, and when one of the officers came along, he took my gun away. He said, "You get in that warehouse and open that warehouse for any supplies that people needed." And I was really scared. And some of the bullets, you see, we're right next to Hickam Air Force Base, and they were strafing the planes on the airfield. And a couple of bullets came right through the roof of our, we had a tin roof, and that scared the heck out of me. It lasted for 2 hours, and it seemed like 2 days. You really don't have time to think. You're just acting. It really scared me.
For the nation, Pearl Harbor became such a rallying cry. Remember Pearl Harbor was really what everyone got behind and motivated them to fight the enemy. What about for you, having experienced and seen that devastation firsthand on December 7th? Is that something that kind of stuck in your mind as you went out to fight the Japanese in the Pacific?
It always did. It always will. That's why I enjoy coming here to tell my story to the people who visit us.
That's Pearl Harbor survivor Al Rodriguez in an interview recorded at the USS Arizona Memorial Visitor Center at Pearl Harbor, where people from all over the world have heard his story, have shaken his hand, and hopefully read his book. You heard him mention that his Navy outpost there was near Hickam Field, which was a brand new air base on Oahu in December 1941. Hickam is where Ed Hall found himself that Sunday morning. The South Carolina native was in a mess hall getting breakfast ready. He dismissed the first explosion he heard as an air compressor firing up, but the next one could not be explained away.
And then I heard the darndest explosion you'd ever want to hear in your life. Now I thought something blew up outside. I ran to the back door, looked up Hangar Avenue. Hangar 7 and 9 had blown up and debris was flying everywhere. And I thought, my God, an airplane exploded in one of the hangars? And then about that time, Hangar 2 and 4 was right across the street from me. The entrance was in line with the door where I was standing. Guys were running out of the hangar, scattering all over everywhere. And then I saw puffs of asphalt kicking up. What the hey? And then I saw this plane coming across the runway the wrong way. Holy mackerel, who's this idiot? And then I realized that's gunfire. And this plane is coming right at me. And this guy is so low, he couldn't have been more than 25, 30 feet off the ground. But he had to pull up to miss the building and the electrical wires that were outside. That's what saved my life, because he was coming straight at me. As he flew over, I looked up. He was looking down at me, and I was looking up at him, and he had a big smile on his face. I mean, that's how close he was. And I could see him. So then I went running out hollering for Alex, where is everybody? Well, they had all disappeared. Oh, I got to tell you one other. As I turned around, before I could yell at Alex, I decided I got to hide someplace. Where, oh, the kitchen sink. So I dived under the kitchen sink. And things seemed to quiet down just for a second or so, and that's when I got out, started yelling for Alex, and I ran outside, and now I'm still in awe. I'm staring out in the air, looking at all these planes flying around. And one guy reaches out from under the eave of a building, grabs me by the shoulder, curses me out, you're going to get killed, get under here. And I didn't more than get under the eave of that building. Here comes another plane strafing, took off about 2 inches of that edge of that building, number two.
Second time your life was saved.
Second time. So now this is the Hickwood, the mess hall. I got to get down to the motor pool because I know they're going to need drivers. So I go down there, and I was told to take a truck and go up Hangar Avenue and do whatever I could to help out. Well, it always, even to this day, it seems a mystery to me how this happened. But as I got up near the hangars, it had exploded, which was right across the street was the big barracks. And the guy come running out, waving his hands, stop, stop. I need you, I need you. I said, who are you? He said, I'm a medic. We got wounded. We got to get them to the hospital. So that's what I did for the rest of the day. And then we took a load over to the hospital, came back over on Hangar Avenue, and went in between the hangars picking up wounded. I picked up one dead lieutenant, and he had a .45 automatic. I figured, well, his guts are spilled all over it. He don't need it. So I took his .45 and never cleaned that belt either. It still had blood on it the day I had to turn it in when I came back to the States. But I believe it was the second or could have been the third trip that we made. We got strafed again. The tires were shot out on the truck, and we had bullets come between him and myself through the cab that just missed both of us. Actually, we didn't realize that until we stopped and picked up another wounded. Well, we stopped when the tires went flat. Not to pick up a wounded, really, but there was wounded there. And as he got out, went to shut the door, he says, my God, Ed, look at the holes in the roof. I look at it, my Lord, where did it? And then I realized the tires had been shot out, and these handgun bullets came through the roof of the cab, number three. Well, that was my three close calls for the day. So the rest of the next 2 or 3 hours, we were still roaming around looking for wounded. I couldn't tell you how many people we picked up that were wounded.
Are we talking like dozens?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah, at least. And I believe I just knew these fellows. I can't say they were friends, but they were acquaintances. Leonard Beasley, Eugene Denson, and Robert Kelly. Now, Robert Kelly I knew real well. They were killed that day, those three. All three of them belonged to the 42nd Bomb Squadron.
That is Ed Hall remembering three of the 189 airmen killed at Hickam Field on December 7th, 1941. It's time for our first break. So far, we've heard from three men who were there on Oahu on America's first day of World War II, but there are many more to come on this special Pearl Harbor 77th anniversary edition of Hometown Heroes. Link to all the original interviews at hometownheroesradio.com. Find photos on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And join us. We'll be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.